Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Last week, the U.S. Department of Education initiated a reduction in force as part of Donald Trump's downsizing of the federal government. Roughly 50%, 50% of the workforce in that agency, 2,183 workers, will be placed on administrative leave this Friday. Trump, along with his choice to be Secretary of Education, Linda McMahon, intend to eventually dissolve the department, they say, to send control of education back to the states. The layoffs include those working in key offices, like the Federal Student Aid Office and the Office for Civil Rights, and critics of this move argue these changes could hinder the department's ability to fulfill its responsibilities, such as investigating discrimination cases and ensuring access to education for students with disabilities. And many of these cuts could hurt HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities, where an abundance of students depend on federal funding for their educations. We're going to talk about all of this. Later in the program, we'll hear from leaders at two private HBCUs in our area, Johnson C. Smith University here in Charlotte and Clinton College in Rock Hill. But we start with a conversation about the Department of Education itself, its mission, what it has done historically, and the impact these cuts might have on the department and the constituencies that it serves around the country. Catherine Knott covers all of that in her capacity as news editor at Inside Higher Ed, which focuses on a wide range of topics and trends impacting colleges and universities. Catherine, thank you for being here. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with what the Department of Education actually does. There seems to be a lot of lack of understanding, a lot of dis and information about what it does and how involved it gets in classrooms at school systems around the country. And this is why, in part, the idea of paring back or ending the Department of Education is so appealing to a lot of people. They have a misconception of what it does. So exactly what is that department's mission?
Its mission is to support schools from K-12 to post-secondary and enforce civil rights and give out financial aid. I mean, it's wide-ranging, but we really see it as like a support agency that keeps schools going. I mean, the first important thing to know about the department is that it doesn't really have anything to do with curriculum in schools. It's really an agency that gets money to schools and students and enforces the civil rights of students in the schools.
So I want to underline that, because a lot of people on the right sincerely believe that they have their fingers in the pies, they have their fingers in the lesson plans that teachers make up for their students every day. In fact, they do not, as you just said, they do not control the curriculum, but they do control purse strings. Are the purse strings attached in any way to what is being taught and how it is being taught?
Really, not that we've seen. There's been some talk of trying to leverage like the access to federal student aid or federal money in any ways to get to compel schools to act. But you know, the most prominent example that we have of that is around Title IX, which is the gender equity law. So of like ensuring students have certain rights, and if you don't comply with that law, you'll lose your federal funding. Theoretically, I mean, the department's never pulled federal funding from an agency, at least not until recently. But that big like kind of hammer is not that has been in the department's history.
So there is misinformation and misunderstanding about what the Department of Education is and what it does, and that much of that is spread through media and other sources. But people in government, people at the White House, people within the Congress, they know. Would I be wrong in saying that they know what this agency actually does? So any misinformation coming from them would be a lie. Is that correct?
I would certainly hope that they know what the agency does. Now, the department's very complicated, but I wouldn't go so far to say that they're lying. But if they are trafficking misinformation, they're either doing so willful.
Why wouldn't that be considered a lie? If you know what you're saying is not true, that shows intent, and therefore you are lying.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I don't have like a specific comment that I'm thinking of. I mean, I've spent my fair share in the congressional committee hearings over the years, and those people in the committee know what the department is talking about, but not everyone in Congress, I think, is familiar with the workings of the department because it's only like one committee in the Senate and the House that deal with it.
So this idea of turning education back to the states is really a misnomer, because they're not involved in it in the first place. But it appears to be aimed at correcting some sort of what they perceive to be government interference in education, particularly at the elementary and secondary school levels. Are the efforts of the Department of Education generally focused on those levels of education, or do people believe that their tentacles go higher up?
I mean, I think the department's actually more focused on higher education. I mean, we've seen that they have a lot more to do and they have a lot more power over the higher education system than they do in K-12, where states already have a lot of say over what schools are doing. I think states do have control over curriculum. I mean, there's a lot of power that states have over the K-12 system, that the department in the K-12 space, the department is mainly handing out money, and enforcing the law that supports students with disabilities.
And at the higher levels of education, a lot of their work, as I understand it, deals with funding and grants, federal funding to support schools, education programs, student aid. They run the Pell Grant program for students who demonstrate exceptional financial need. And they're also involved in student loans. The department is involved in developing and enforcing policy and ensuring compliance with laws like the Every Student Succeeds Act, which replaced the No Child Left Behind Act, and that empowers individual states to develop their own accountability systems for student access. They're also involved with the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, along with civil rights enforcement. Which of these, if any of them, seem to be the reason behind efforts to downsize and eventually close this department? Why would you want to do that?
I mean, the department's existed since 1979, right? And pretty much since the department was created, Republicans have wanted to get rid of it. It's been a symbol more than anything of like federal government bloat and excess. And then as we saw the talks around getting rid of the department really ramped up, I would say, during the Biden administration, as the Biden administration was using Title IX to expand protections for transgender students. And we saw a lot of backlash from Republican states about that plan. And then we also saw around the student loan forgiveness efforts that just really galvanized Republicans against the department and kind of saying, like, you clearly can't run the system. So like let's give, the $1.7 trillion student loan portfolio to another agency to run it, because if your only answer to fix it is forgiveness, like we don't need a department anyway. But I think it's just really been a symbol. People argue it's not constitutional because there's no, the word education doesn't appear in the Constitution. So it's like federal government overreach. And it's, can't emphasize enough, I think a lot of the complaints about the department are more about like symbolic overreach of the federal government than more specific complaints. People do have specific issues with the department. And even people that want the department to stick around argue, yes, it could be run better. Last year, we saw the meltdown with the federal student aid application. So there are some issues at the department, of course. But a lot of the arguments I've heard from people who want it gone just say, like, well, the system's not working, so let's try something different
But
in a lot of different.
several of the specific things that you mentioned seem to be programs or orders that were coming from the Biden White House, not from the Department of Education. They were simply executing orders transmitted by the Biden White House, much the same as they would be executing orders being transmitted by the Trump White House. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, I mean, the department leadership was pretty involved in Title IX, but yes, it's still like those are like political priorities of an administration that they were executing through the department. And the department, has gotten more involved in higher education in recent years, particularly as Congress isn't passing a lot of laws related to higher education reform. So basically, the only space to make changes in higher ed policy at the federal level is like through rules and regulations, which colleges don't love as much because they change with every administration. We've kind of had like a decade or more of like kind of whiplash in terms of like you get used to a set of policies, new administration comes in, they rewrite those policies. And that's solely because Congress isn't doing a lot here in terms of passing substantial legislation related to higher education policy.
So while education, at least at the primary and secondary levels, is primarily the purview of state and local governments and officials, the Department of Education does provide support to states as well as oversight to ensure a quality education for all students. That's, I think, part of the wording on their website. We know from test scores here in Charlotte and around the country that not every child is receiving that quality education for various reasons. Is that the fault of the Department of Education, or is that the fault of local school systems, or the fault of lack of funding from various states, including North Carolina? Where does the blame lie for that?
I don't want to get too far over my skis here, as I do mainly cover higher education in terms of K-12. But I would say the department, I don't hear a lot of people saying the department has a lot to do in improving test scores. But what the department does do is provide the data that shows that students aren't doing as well or are doing well, on the nation's report card. And that's one of the things that, the staff that oversee that the test that's called the nation's report card was cut pretty heavily last week. So I think there's a lot of questions going forward on what kind of data we're going to have out of the department when it comes to how are students doing in schools and are they learning, are they reading? But based on what I did cover K-12, I'd say funding has a big piece of it
What
from
one
my
of the first
viewpoint.
things that the Donald Trump administration has gone after is DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. They did it throughout the government, and they're doing it as well through the Department of Education to other entities like colleges and universities. Those colleges and universities began working on their DEI programs in the 70s, many of them. And it was just in 2019 that the University of North Carolina beefed up its DEI programs and goals by creating the UNC System Diversity Council, which aimed at assisting low-income and first-generation college students. In September of 2020, at the end of Trump's first term, he signed an executive order banning DEI programs in the government and the military, something that was eventually reversed by President Biden. And now those bans, of course, are back and broader than ever. So, how much of a wrench has this thrown into the works at schools across the country, particularly colleges and universities, Catherine?
I mean, I'd say it's thrown an incredible wrench because schools and colleges aren't sure how exactly they can comply with these sweeping directives that ban illegal diversity, equity, and inclusion. The orders don't define it. And we've seen the department release kind of vague and overbroad guidance about, get rid of all race-based activities and programming. And I think colleges are just really wondering, well, what exactly does that mean and how can we comply? And absent that, we're seeing colleges, kind of preemptively comply by shuttering more, diversity, equity, inclusion offices, suspending some programs, changing residential communities to kind of get away from anything that did like support, like Black students in particular, even if the housing community wasn't just for Black students, but it supported Black students, that's gone. I think we've seen that in NC State. So there's just, I think we've seen a lot of changes being made in a very quick amount of time in the last, 8 weeks. I mean, there's a real dismantling of DEI on college campuses going on right now. And a lot of that is just as colleges don't know enough to comply. And so they're just trying to avoid federal scrutiny as best as possible.
I want to follow up on the impact of DEI and how schools are handling it and what it's done to them. And are they, in their efforts to comply with DEI, are they also perhaps skirting with breaking other laws that are still on the books? And we'll talk about the layoffs at the Department of Education and their impact. And then we'll be joined by Dr. Patrick Martin, the provost at Johnson C. Smith University, and Archenia Ingram, acting president of Clinton College in Rock Hill, when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the impact of cutbacks at the Department of Education and what that may mean for colleges and universities and other institutions of education around the country. And we'll be speaking to two people heading up two HBCUs in our area in a moment. But we're talking right now with Catherine Knott, who is news editor of Inside Higher Ed. They focus on what we're talking about today and many other aspects of higher education. In 2023, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a decision involving both Harvard University and the University of North Carolina, ruled that race conscious admissions policies at those schools were unconstitutional, and those schools then responded by adjusting those policies. And now with these executive orders that ban or have economic threats attached to continuing with DEI programs, a lot of colleges have been scrambling to erase DEI efforts that they have spent years in building up. What will be, Catherine, the consequence of that?
I mean, as we're seeing this kind of sweeping away of a lot of these structures, you know, I think the consequence and what we're hearing from experts is it's going to hinder student success. It's going to hinder college access. It's going to hinder college attainment. Like, these are a lot of programs that were designed to support students and help them get through college. And when we talked to some experts, have asked them, like, what is your DEI hill to die on? Like, what would you want a college to keep? And a lot of it was like multicultural centers, keeping inclusive teaching practices, things that are proven to like work and help all students, but particularly students that there are barriers to college completion. And I think they're in with the ban on DEI, the way the administration is interpreting that Supreme Court decision. I think anything that seems to support students differently or take into account that students have different experiences and that might affect their education attainment is gonna be harder for colleges to do.
The Department of Education has an Office for Civil Rights, and they work to ensure that students are not discriminated against based on race or gender, disability, or other protected categories. How will the erasure of DEI combined with the downsizing of that department through the cutbacks that are already underway at the Department of Education and perhaps the eventual closure of the Department of Education, how will that impact the department's ability to function in the civil rights space?
Oh, I mean, I think it's going to make it incredibly difficult. They lost half their staff, and this is a department, this is an office at the department that got more than, you know, the not can't remember the number off my head, but it's thousands of complaints last year, like more than 18,000 complaints. They had a backlog already, like they were not investigating all those complaints, and now they're going to be without half that staff. So it's, you know, the department, the Biden administration just last year was pleading with Congress for more staff at the Office for Civil Rights to investigate complaints, particularly around anti-Semitism, as Congress was like really focused on that. They were like, give us more money, give us more help. And now that agency has half the amount of staff, you know.
These rifts, these reductions in reductions in they go into effect on Friday, and the courts are working to reverse many of these Trump layoffs. Thousands of federal workers in all departments have been removed from their jobs and are in limbo, and thousands of more from the Department of Education will join them this week. 50% of their staff scheduled to be furloughed on Friday. That's around 2,183 workers, and that means fully staffed, the Department of Education only had 4,000 workers to deal with the entire country. What will this loss of personnel do to their ability to carry out their core functions? You've already alluded to the fact that they couldn't get to some things even fully staffed. So what will this do to them? Will this cripple them?
I think that's what we're hearing from experts. Now, to be fair, the department says the layoffs aren't going to affect any of the critical functions at the department. But when they said that last week, we heard deep skepticism from the higher education community that would be true. You know, you're talking about the staff that supports the federal student aid application, which 18 million people fill out every year. The Office for Civil Rights, the data office that collects a lot of data about students at the K-12 and post-secondary system has less than 20 people in it now. It had more than 100. Before the layoffs. So I think there's just a lot of skepticism that the department's going to be able to function and maintain its core functions. But that's what the department is saying. And I think it's going to be up to the department to present a plan and prove that that's true at this point.
Linda McMahon, who is the new Secretary of Education, who comes to education from the world of professional wrestling, has said that the reduction in workforce, quote, reflects the department's commitment to efficiency, accountability, and ensuring that resources are directed where they matter most to students, parents, and teachers. So was the department bloated? Is there any evidence that cutting half the staff is going to improve efficiency or increase accountability?
What we heard from the loudest critics who want the department gone last week was time will tell. So I think there's been arguments and theories that the department is bloated and didn't need as many staff as they currently had or they had to support it. But I think we're going to test the theory. Like, there's not been, from my understanding, there's not been many studies that have like effectively proven that there's bloat or excess at the department. It's one of the smallest federal agencies. So as the conservative critic said, time will tell.
Linda McMahon is fully committed to Donald Trump's goal of shuttering the department. She told staffers to prepare for a momentous final mission to eliminate bureaucratic bloat. Those are her words. And return education to the states, assuming that she was talking about the impending reduction in force. How do you define bureaucratic bloat? I'm just trying to get to the bottom of this, because we're told that all these federal agencies have too many people in them doing God knows what, and that's what they're trying to pare down. But we have no evidence that it's going to work.
Yeah, that's true. And from my understanding of the education department, they have been struggling to get through their issue, like the paperwork backlogs with fully staffed. Like, the department has been struggling to fulfill all of its responsibilities. So I just didn't hear a lot of people that work with the department day in and day out, especially from colleges, saying, wow, that department is overstaffed. You know, in fact, like, we need more support there so they could process applications. You know, if a college wants to merge, they got to file paperwork with the department. If you want a no program, you got to file paperwork with the department. And, you know, those agencies, those people on the ground and the regional offices that would be the front lines accepting that paperwork and helping colleges with those processes, you know, they were also laid off.
Well, is that what they're talking when they talk about bureaucratic bloat? And when they talk about, like, in Trump's executive order to downsize the Department of Education, he directed Linda McMahon, the secretary, to take all the necessary steps to return authority over education to the states. That sounds like they're interfering in everything the states are trying to do in education. But is it more that these colleges and universities and school systems around the country have to deal in all this paperwork that then they have to go through and approve and put their stamp on? Is that what they're really complaining about?
I mean, I think so, but the people that want the department gone and the administration themselves, they're not defining it. So I'm trying not to give them do their job too much for them, since they have not defined what the bureaucratic bloat is or really articulated, you know, what they want to go away. And it's important to note that all that red tape that colleges and folks have been complaining about, that still exists, even if the staff aren't there to fulfill those processes, because you have to get rid of the rules if you're going to reduce the red tape. So it's kind of like starting by gutting the staff, and now they're theoretically going to follow up and get rid of the red tape. But until that goes away, colleges are still going to be held to, you know, some of these processes and requirements.
So as somebody who covers this on a daily basis, when Donald Trump's executive order says to take all the necessary steps to return authority for education over to the states, aside from this paperwork, what powers will the department be turning over to the states? And if they are numerous or even a few, are the states equipped to take up the slack?
I mean, I'm still waiting for the department to spell out what they mean by saying we're going to return power to the states, because as someone that covers it day in and day out and understands the federal role in higher education, it doesn't fully make sense to me. But I would say, you know, states are going to have to pick up a lot more slack. And we're at a time where a lot of states nationwide are cutting budgets and rethinking things. So I'm skeptical, and I've talked to other people who are skeptical as well, that states can sufficiently pick up the slack. I mean, are they going to be asked to distribute student loans and run the Pell Grant program? Probably not. But we really haven't seen a plan from the department about what they mean when they say we're going to dismantle or like reduce to the maximum extent of the law. Like, we just don't know what that actually means. And I think we're constantly asking and waiting for the Trump administration to explain its plan here.
So many of the changes in Washington, from the downsizing of the Department of Education to the mandate to drop any mention of diversity, equity, inclusion, DEI, are hitting colleges and universities, all of which are scrambling to deal with this new approach, knowing that if they don't respond, many of them risk losing federal funding. These actions will also impact historically black colleges and universities, even private ones, and they too are bracing for impact. And to give us some insight into how those schools are planning for these changes, I want to welcome Dr. Patrick Martin, the provost at Johnson C. Smith University, with us in Charlotte, and Archenia Ingram, the interim president at Clinton College in Rock Hill. I want to thank you both for joining us. And Catherine Knott will remain with us. She is the news editor at Inside Education. Dr. Martin, let me begin with you. Many public universities, like those in the University of North Carolina system, have been immediately affected by the change in DEI policy at the federal level. In response, the UNC Board of Governors voted to repeal its DEI policies. But Johnson C. Smith is a private university and a historically black college and university. Will any of these changes in DEI impact your school?
Well, thanks once again. Well, thank you and good morning to all your listeners and followers. Pleasure to be on to have opportunity to speak on behalf of HBCUs and specifically private HBCUs. As far as the question is concerned, DEI at a private institution, will it be affected? It will be affected by the fact that if some of the funding or the executive orders directly affect some of our funding that would come, as we've talked about earlier today, from the Department of Education. We have several grants, we have several student-based success programs that are primarily or 100% funded through the Department of Education. And that if these funds are deemed DEI and support DEI, we could be potentially having to reduce or lose those funds. Thus, that could mean we reduce or lose certain programs.
Following the federal government's move to end DEI and to punish any entity that receives federal funding if they don't comply, JCSU President Valerie Kinloch commented to the Charlotte Observer that DEI had been part of the fabric of the college from its inception. So, if that's true, what changes are you making, are you planning to make, might you have to make to be in compliance?
Well, we have begun to review our funding portfolio, especially those that come from federal funds and the Department of Education. We have taken some action in which we have begin to remind or tell some of our faculty and staff that are supported by these grants that we may have to change how you're funded or how your funds come through in the future. We have begun to reach out to external groups, philanthropic groups, to potentially pick up some of the support that we could potentially lose, again, if these executive orders hold true to their initial orders.
And Dr. Archenia Ingram is a doctoral candidate, but she's the president of Clinton College, and I have the same questions for you. How is this going to impact Clinton?
But first, Mike, again, thank you for having us on this morning, and for this opportunity to really help to educate those who are all learning about the impact of the rollback of DEI, not only to HBCUs, but the impact beyond that. We have to understand that DEI is bigger than, and I know we're focusing on HBCUs, but we're talking about the impact for women, for people with disabilities, even military veterans. And so it's important for us to understand what these initiatives and how these initiatives would impact us. Within our institutions and beyond. Much like Johnson C. Smith, we have certainly been educating ourselves on these impacts. Clinton, right now, we have about $5 million in these federal grants that are minority focused. And so we have been working with the philanthropic community to tell the story of Clinton and to tell how these potential rollbacks would impact our students directly. And I think that's important for us to know that the rollback of these federal dollars is bigger than just politics. it impacts the lives of our students. Those first generation low income students who rely on those scholarships and those mentorship programs and those well-being and mental wellness programs, it has a real impact on our students. And so we're working to tell that story to our local philanthropic community and beyond, so that we can then figure out ways that we won't lose that support for our students. We are also reviewing our portfolio. And so we are working intentionally and proactively to educate our community within our campus and beyond, so that we can all understand the impact of this rollback, and then working with our community on how we can offset those services so that we can continue to do what HBCUs have always done, and that is to support our students beyond the systemic inequalities that they often face day to day.
I'm going to ask both of the college-associated individuals on the program this morning the same question, and I'll start with you, Archenia. Of all the changes that you're witnessing at the Department of Education, all of these DEI rules that have come down from the Trump administration, et cetera, which do you find to be the most concerning?
For me, I think it's the reduction in force in the Department of Education. And the talks to eradicate DOE totally. That's what's most concerning for me at this point. Again, we're already facing backlog with processing financial aid for our students and things of that nature. Rolling back those services will have, or those personnel will have, a direct impact on funding our students' financial aid. That will impact, you know, the operation of our institutions. So right now, that's the biggest impact, I think, that I'm most concerned about at this point.
Dr. Martin, I have about a minute left.
I would concur that the most direct currently right now is the reduction in force. We saw significant delays last year when the FAFSA form changed and our students being funded through financial aid. Again, just the amount of time it takes to get paperwork or response from the Department of Education when it's associated with a grant or any type of federal funding, it's probably going to be delayed even further, which then has downstream delays and activities and functions for our faculty, staff, and students here at the university. But really concerning is if they really do pull this funding from other Department of Education related grants. I think last time I checked, we had $5.5 million in Department of Education grants that could be potentially removed.
Funding through grants and student loans is one of the important things that the Department of Education does. I want to talk more about that when we come back in Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about changes at the Department of Education brought on by the Trump administration and their impact on education at all levels, but particularly with the focus this hour on HBCUs. Catherine Knott is with us. She's news editor at the Inside Higher Ed that writes about this on a weekly basis. Dr. Patrick Martin is provost at Johnson C. Smith University, and Archenia Ingram is acting president at Clinton College in Rock Hill. As I said in the beginning, Dr. Martin, a large number of Johnson C. Smith students depend on federal funding to pay for various aspects of their education. How many would you say rely on some sort of funding that is controlled in some way by the Department of Education?
So we have approximately 1,350 students, and 90% of those depend on federal financial aid. So it's for some percentage of their financial planning for to attend Johnson C. Smith University is regulated through federal financial aid. So as you can see that we have a large percentage of our students, the majority, the strong majority, that are supported by federal financial aid.
Archenia, you have said that you are uncertain about what is happening in Washington. I think that everybody is uncertain about that, and you're uncertain about what impact that will have. But you are certain that there will be some impact, and you specifically mentioned your concern over the timing of the processing of financial aid for students, because you are a tuition-driven institution. What do you mean about the timing of this?
As Dr. Martin alluded to earlier, last year with the change of the FAFSA applications, we, all institutions, experienced a tremendous
delay. Excuse me, define FAFSA for those people who don't know what you're talking about.
The Federal Application for Federal Student Aid is the application that students complete to request monies for Pell Grants, student loans, et cetera. And so students have to complete that FAFSA application, and then that they're determined whether they qualify for what we call Title IV funding. That's the Pell Grant student loans, which much like Johnson C. Smith, about 95% of our students rely on those Title IV funding or that Pell Grant and student loan funding. Delays in processing those applications would result in the delay of the allocation of those funds to our institutions. By our institution being tuition driven, that means the majority of our operational budget is derived from those Pell Grant and Title IV dollars. The delay in receiving those funds would be the delay in the operation of our institution. And so that's why it's important for us to understand how these delays may impact not only Clinton, but most HBCUs that are tuition driven and rely on those funds for our day-to-day operation.
Are you tuition driven because you're private and you're not a public entity, therefore you're not getting a lot of public dollars like the University of North Carolina system or the University of South Carolina system would get, I guess, in your case? So in other words, if you're facing these challenges as a privately operated HBCU, would other private non-HBCUs be facing the same challenge?
That is correct, Mike.
Okay. HBCUs have been struggling in general, for years, many have closed. Do these adjustments to the Department of Education and whatever roadblocks to student funding there may be that might be erected in the coming months make survival for your institutions even more difficult? I want to hear from both of you. Dr. Martin, I'll begin with you.
I think when we talk about survival of an institution, I think we're getting to the extremes of the conversation there. It would be extremely challenging for our students to definitely matriculate into the institution and pay for their college education if Title IV funding was somehow inhibited or decreased. But currently, all the talks that we have heard and the conversations we have heard, the Title IV funding is safe. And so therefore, it would be safe for students to utilize the Pell Grants and student loans. So survival, I think, is a strong, very strong word. It will be very challenging. I think at Johnson C. Smith, as well as many other HBCUs and many other private institutions and even public institutions, we're having to really look at our efficiency. What things can we tighten our belts on? Are there vacant positions that we need to remain vacant so we can have those funds to float towards financial aid? Or maybe even we even have some offices and some faculty and some staff who are 100% paid through Department of Education funding. So how do we maintain those positions? So I think at this point in time, survival is not where we're at. We're looking at how do we move through these challenging times and get to the other side of these challenging times.
What's your take on that, Archina?
I concur with Dr. Martin. I certainly don't think that these changes would impact the survival of our institutions, but they will pose some challenges with how we operate. And we're also looking at much of the same areas, faculty and staff, as far as those who are on those grants, how do we realign them, realign our operations? So I think that though, because we are educating ourselves, we're all being proactive. And I've had an opportunity to talk to some of my colleagues in the industry. And one thing about HBCUs, we've always been resilient. We were founded because of the exclusion from PWIs of predominantly white institutions. And we've been able throughout generations, been able to matriculate ourselves or move ourselves through these challenges. And I feel very confident that we're gonna continue to do that through the programmings that we have, the support that we have, and just the resilience of our institutions. But we're gonna work through these challenges. We're gonna work together as an industry. And we're going to educate folks on the impact of these DEI rollbacks, and we're going to continue to thrive. The great thing about HBCUs, we are here. So when students feel like they don't have anywhere else to go, these HBCUs will still be here and present to provide that education that will change the trajectory of their lives.
Catherine, many, if not most, of these changes to all of these various departments, including the Department of Education at the federal level, are allegedly focused on getting rid of waste and abuse and fraud. The word fraud has not surfaced, I don't think, in regard to the Department of Education. But when you cut the staff by 2,000 and then you promise to shutter it completely, that's 4,000 people. I don't know what they make, but it seems like a drop in the bucket when you take $4,000 times a government salary, an average government salary. But the Department of Education also funds a lot of student educations. When you add all that together, it has to be in the tens to hundreds of millions of dollars. But is that a significant impact if you want to tighten the belt of the federal government? Would that be significant savings?
I mean, just to put some context, the federal budget is more than, I think it's in the trillions. The education department budget is about $80 billion for discretionary. They might, and then they give out $100 million, I think. Yeah, like student loans, $30 billion. These might be billions. I'm sorry.
No, I have those figures. They have. Yes. They issue about $100 billion in student loans every year, more than $50 billion in Pell grants, and they have an $80 billion discretionary budget.
Yes, I figured million was too small. When we talk about the student loan program, but that is still a drop in the bucket when it comes to the federal budget. This is not the area where there's a lot of. This is not how you want to reduce.
So are these moves with regard to the Department of Education more about politics and philosophy than they are about money?
I would say so, because they're also not planning to get rid of the student loan program, which is the $100 billion, right, a year. So it's really about politics at this point.
Are these changes wrong-headed or are they simply different?
It's not entirely for me to say at this point, but they, without a plan, it seems that there is going to be a lot of disruptions to students and families and institutions. And I don't see how that achieves the goals of the federal government and helps institutions.
Archina and Dr. Martin, talk to me about that. People don't like change. This is definitely a major change. But is the change simply different and you'll have to get used to it and you'll survive and all things will be well in the end? Or are these wrongheaded and have an agenda attached to them that if we knew the true agenda, we would be troubled by? I'll start with you, Archina.
I feel that we'll be able to navigate the changes. And I think we'll make the adjustments and we will continue to offer the educational opportunities that we are offering. I do think that there may be some agendas there, it happens in politics. But as far as our institutions are concerned, we're going to survive. We're going to navigate through these changes and we'll be able to make the adjustments as we've done for generations to continue to provide education.
Dr. Martin?
I'm not going to get into the fact whether or not their agenda is there. I think as a institute of higher education, we teach our students to be critical thinkers, to be flexible, to be nimble. And so as institutions, we're going to have to demonstrate that. We're going to have to live through these challenging times. And as I've said for many weeks now, that Johnson C. Smith was founded in 1867. We've been here close to 150 years now, and I think we'll survive and continue. We might have to right size, as they say in the industry. But as Archina said, we're going to continue to survive and thrive and provide a wonderful education for our students and a wonderful place for our alumni to come back and call home.
Catherine.
Mike, if I could just add that I think it's important to understand the broader context that all of this is happening in. We are seeing, and multiple experts have told us, that there is a broader assault on higher education underway in terms of thinking about the principles that have undergirded the whole system: academic freedom, institutional autonomy, kind of staying out of colleges' ways. For particular colleges, it probably won't be HBCUs at this point, but especially elite universities. The administration has pulled $400 million from Columbia. They are expecting, as a part of a precondition to negotiations, massive changes at the institution. Today, the union at Columbia called that a ransom note. There is something different in the way that the federal government is approaching higher education that we have not seen historically. And it just is way too early to tell about where that goes. But there is just something different in the water when it comes to thinking about higher education.
Is it healthy or is it simply a political maneuvering?
I mean, it's all political maneuvering at this point.
Okay.
In terms of the attacks on elite institutions.
Dr. Martin, Johnson C. Smith University receives about $10 million, as I understand it, from the federal government. Is that separate from whatever money is going to students to pay tuition and expenses?
That's correct. So the $10 million that you're referring to there are through what we would call grants or contracts that we have with different federal agencies. And then the Title IV that Archenia spoke about earlier, that relates to financial aid and how financial aid and Pell Grant and student loans are deviated out to the different students who need it. So currently the $10 million are grants that I say support research, support academic enhancement, support student success.
And that comes from the Department of Education?
Yes, that comes from the Department of Education.
Are you similarly positioned, Archenia?
We are. Currently, we have about $5 million in federal grants that we're managing and navigating that's separate from the Title IV funding that we receive. And so that's the impact that it could have on our institution is about $5 million between federal grants and contracts.
I believe it's accurate to say that both JCSU and Clinton are working to find alternative sources of money just in case. How concerned are you, Doctor, or either of you, about some or all of the federal money that you might receive that might go away? And what would be the result if they pulled the plug today, Archenia?
I'm concerned, as most of my colleagues are, or all of my colleagues are in the industry. However, I'm reassured and confident that we'll be able to realign our institution to be able to find alternative ways to support the initiatives that these grants support. One thing that we've done at Clinton that was really early on a decision that we made with managing grants, just from understanding a business model of operation, we don't have a large number of our faculty and staff on our grants. I mean, it's a small percentage of our staff that's actually funded through our grants. That is with intention because grants do come and go. We understand that. Most of our grants support programming and initiatives, support our technology advancements, student services, scholarships, things of that nature. So there are alternatives for us to consider. And again, we are telling our story to the philanthropic community to try and offset some of those costs and telling folks what their dollars would do for Clinton and specifically in those particular areas. So I feel confident that we'll be able to realign ourselves without losing the student services that we're providing and without losing a large number of our faculty and staff or any of our faculty and staff from these DEI rollback initiatives.
Dr. Martin?
So we are concerned. Right now we're preparing a report for our Board of Trustees on the grants that could be affected and those individuals that could be affected. Similar to what Clinton College is doing, we've begun probably about a year and a half ago to roll faculty and staff as much as possible off of what we call soft money or grant money so that they're now in our operational budget. And we just did that exercise a few months ago when we looked at next year's fiscal year budget. I'm always concerned. I see faculty, staff, and students that I personally know that are supported by these grants. And I wonder if they are yanked as of Friday. I mean, what do we do with some of them that we have not rolled off? We have been strategically aligning ourselves with philanthropic opportunities, corporate support opportunities to support some of these programs and initiatives so that they can continue without disruption, so that our students can get the best that they have to offer from these programs and initiatives.
I have less than a minute left. Your publication, Catherine, has said that cutting staff and programs will be catastrophic for institutions, and I'm not hearing the alarm in the voices of our two other guests. Is that overstating the problem?
I mean, I think we've definitely heard that from advocates and from folks in D.C. I think everyone is also trying to look at it optimistically. I think it's... I think Dr. Martin, President Ingram, I'm glad you guys feel optimistic in it. That is not what we are hearing from everyone. But I guess like chaos and uncertainty is kind of the vibe right now. And that's leading to.
And part of the uncertainty is it legal for the Trump administration to shutter a federal department, the Department of Education? That is to be seen, I suppose. Catherine Knott, news editor of Inside Higher Ed, Dr. Patrick Martin from Johnson C. Smith University, and Archenia Graham from Clinton College. Thanks.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.